Greetings, everyone. This is Carl from Carl's Cavern. Thank you for joining us for the first in a weekly series in the month of June that is celebrating the LGBTQ Pride Month and also the 50th anniversary of Stonewall riots. First off, I'd like to say hello to my regulars here. We have Chrissy. Say hello, Chrissy.
Hello. Greetings.
And we also have our wonderful producer, which is Doc. Say hello, Doc.
Good evening, everybody. How are you?
Greetings, O Great Wizard.
Yes, that's true. So anyway, our guest is a very close friend of mine. One of the seminal people, he was the second president of the GAA, which is the Gay Activist Alliance. His photos of the era are all throughout New York right now being shown. He is also on the advisory board of the Gay Senior Center in Queens. And it's someone that I'm very, very proud to know quite well. And our first guest for this month, I'd like to welcome Richard Wandel. Hello, Richard.
Hello. How are you, Carl?
Not too bad. How about yourself?
Doing well.
Well, good. So anyway, why don't you give a little bit of background about yourself and just give us basic how you all fit into the history of Stonewall.
I've been kicking around for a few years, starting in about 1971 or so with the Gay Activist Alliance here in New York, which at the time was the most active political LGBT organization. I was the second president of that organization, following the presidency of founder Jim Owls. Did that for a number of years. One of the primary person taking photographs of all of their actions, mainly for PR purposes, so that we could get known. Did a lot of that for a couple of years at that time. What we called ZAPs, which were very militant, although nonviolent, often sit-ins and demonstrations at various fun places. More recently, I became about 27 years ago the founder of the LGBT Community Center's National History Archive. I'm a historian and an archivist, and I did that for some 26 years. And now I'm happily kind of retired, although one never fully retires, does one?
No, never. And I know your schedule. You are not retired. Not by a long shot. But tell us a little bit about your personal journey in terms of, you know, when did you realize you were gay? How your early years, you know, you made certain decisions to become involved with the GAA and become activist. Give us a little bit of background on that, if you can.
Well, I came, as we say, I came out to myself at an age when, in the modern day, we would say is rather late, although it was not unusual at that time. I came out to myself at about the age of 24, after being kind of kicked out of the monastery I had been in for 6 years. And they kind of recognized what was going on actually before I did. But I came out to myself shortly after that. And, of course, at that time, I'm talking about 1969, 1970, actually the spring of 1970. And at that time, you know, there was all these ridiculous stereotypes, but as I discovered myself, that automatically meant that I knew the stereotypes to be untrue, because that wasn't me. I very quickly went from being out to myself to being out to everyone. I could see no point in hiding. The Gay Activist Alliance had already been founded in December of 1969, and they were about, and I discovered them, joined them, and changed my whole life, actually, because I've been doing that or related things ever since.
Mm-hmm. Good. So, Chrissy, do you have any questions or anything you want to ask?
Not right off the bat, no. No, I'm just kind of seeing what direction you're taking it.
Okay. So,
I mean, I'm kind of new to realizing I'm part of this whole LGBTQ thing, even if I am just under the queue there at the end.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, you're certainly joining a very, very vibrant. I think at this point, it's there's a lot going on. As I'm here in the city for the first time in a number of years, the amount of celebrations and the amount of exhibitions and things like that are just incredible at this point. And of course, there was the parade on Sunday, which my church was involved with. So, anyway,
well, I'll
get
tell you
back.
What, he did, if I can say something, he did say something that resonated with me. You talked about how the people around you sort of had a clue before you did, right?
Yes.
I had a similar thing. No, please continue.
I was not sexually active at that point. Although I had, when I was in high school, fooled around a little bit with my best friend, we didn't mm-hmm. define it that way. And,
right.
So we didn't connect. I did not connect that idea. So mm-hmm. by the age of 24, while I'm still in the monastery and they're saying, go away. The reason why I know, they don't tell you anything when they kick you out. It's quite amazing. But I have classmates from that time who remained in the order. And therefore, as they grew older and into various positions, saw all the records. And that's how I know that was the reasoning behind their asking me to leave.
Okay. Well, see, for me, there were a lot of
red flags that were right in front of my face and had been most of my life, but somehow they never actually made it into my awareness. And then I had a friend of mine who, once she kind of gotten to know me well enough to feel comfortable saying it, I gave her an opening, and she's like, so you're gender fluid. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? And then when she explained to me what that was and I realized that was a thing I could be, it made a lot of sense. And I went from 45 years of depression and self-loathing and et cetera, to absolutely loving myself. My whole life is transformed. I couldn't be happier to be out of the closet. I couldn't wait. As soon as I knew about myself, mm-hmm. everyone else did too.
Indeed. There are some difficulties that being out of the closet can produce. In some parts of the world, extremely serious difficulties. But even in the United States, outside of the large cities, it can certainly produce some very real difficulties. However, in my opinion, they are nowhere near as bad as the difficulties of hiding. If you're hiding, your subconscious is constantly telling you that you're bad, that you're not worthy.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're talking about sick or sinful, whatever word you want to use, and that destroys your life. And so,
right. And I never could live up to being a man. I never could fulfill what was a man was supposed to be. But being a woman feels very natural to me.
Uh-huh. Now, you're talking also about gender, not only sexual preference, but gender. And those two things are related, but two different questions. Actually,
exactly. Because I'm attracted to women.
Right.
Right.
So
I'm attracted to women, but my gender is also that of a woman.
I'm attracted to, and gender, of course, is how I is what gender or non-gender I know myself to be.
Right. Yeah. Which is separate then from your sex.
Right. Right.
Unless you happen to be cis, of course.
Right. So. So and the modern as more and more people are talking, as trans people are more and more becoming speaking up for themselves and fighting back. And as some people are also saying, well, I don't need this binary thing at all, whether you're talking mm-hmm. about sexual preference or whether you're talking about gender in either case. I find it all quite delicious. Let's mix it all up because they're all artificial categories anyway.
Mm-hmm. The spectrum.
Right. Exactly. And most people, including gay people, have a hard time stepping out of that binary thinking. I can't tell you the number of times I've been in a discussion with a group of LGBT people, and you say, well, it's a spectrum. Again, whether you're talking about gender or whether you're talking about sexual preference, you say it's a spectrum, and everybody agrees with that, but then they instantly go back to talking about it as if it's a binary. Our culture mm-hmm. is so strong on that, we have a great difficulty in breaking out of that.
And our language is based on binary thinking too. So, I mean, to change our cultural thinking, we're going to have to make fundamental changes in our words.
Correct. In a circular, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg kind of way. But, yes, very definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But done that before, in other words, in other ways. We no longer say mailman, for example. We no longer say fireman. Right, in terms of admitting the total capability of women to do these jobs, also we changed the language, and we can do that again.
Right. Well, we're going to have to. We're going to have this binary thinking because, well, as I was saying, okay, so I'm gender fluid. I am androgynous. I don't have a lot of the body dysmorphia because I accept the fact that I'm both male and female. I'm just sort of, I guess, masculine and sort of a masculine shell, but very feminine inside. But I'm also attracted to women. So what am I? Am I gay? Am I a lesbian in a man's body, or am I a man who likes women, or is it both? I mean, this is where binary thinking really breaks down, because you have people like me that really just say, fuck your binary. It doesn't fit. New paradigm.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I have friends, for example, I have some trans friends. One in particular I've known for, at least 30 years. And it's a trans female. Now, before her realization, before her transition, she was considered to be a man, and she was attracted to women. Well, now she is the woman that she knows herself to be, and of course she's still attracted to women.
Right.
All right? So are we going to say that at one time she was straight and now she's gay? She has to change.
No.
Right? It shows the absurdity of the language.
Right. Exactly. And people tend to forget that the words are just symbols on the surface of the deeper meaning. I think a lot of times even our arguments, we get caught up in, we make a really hell of a good argument semantically, but it utterly fails to prove anything conceptually, which is where it really matters.
Right.
And yet language defines us so strongly, because I hear so many arguments, in moral arguments based on, well, this tautological A plus B equals C that only works on a surface, etymological level. It doesn't work at all when you're dealing with the actual nonverbal realities at work.
Right. And the other thing to note is how culturally specific the binary view is.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you look at many other cultures, they don't talk in terms of two genders. They talk in terms of sometimes a great many genders, but certainly at least three or four. Most Native mm-hmm. American people,
yes.
for example, did not speak in binary terms in terms of gender. And because they did not do so, then they have no reason to think of heterosexual and homosexual either. Regardless
right.
of what was between somebody's legs, if they were a woman, they were a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Plain and simple.
Yep.
And so it's all very, very specific to our culture, this idea that there's two and only two.
Right. And the gender fluidity is only a surprise to cultures like ours. But as you say, there's cultures that forever have had this idea, and we're just now catching
exactly.
up to it.
Exactly.
Now,
I'm
a gender fluid
jump
person.
In here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talking about gender fluidity, I wanted to get back a little bit
Richard, and since Chrissy is only here for a short period of time, there was something else that I wanted just to touch base. So I've known you for a number of years, and I know that you're very spiritual, and of course have was in the monastery and that. And of course we take a look at how religion, you know, or, you know, Judeo-Christian Islamic religion looks at LGBTQ. And
yeah.
I just wanted to get your ideas on that, because we're going to focus on that on one of the subsequent podcasts. And since you're here, I just wanted to get a little bit of background on how, you know, your studies in the monastery and how that has all affected you and where you've gone from there.
Well, strangely enough, by being a part and we're talking about Roman Catholic monastery in this case, by being a part of that and studying philosophy and theology in that context, in a way, it helped me break free of it, because the preaching you hear when you're a person in the pew is actually a lot different than what you hear if you're really studying the subject. For example, take something like like birth control, for example. Well, The thought was, at the time they were first saying this, the thought was that in Middle Ages, that the entire new person was in the male sperm, and that the female only provided a safe place to grow. Okay? Well, that means that something like spilling your seed or you know, a withdrawal or something like that is the same as abortion. But even if you look at abortion, in the pew, the Catholic pew, you're going to always hear, you're killing this baby. If you study Thomas Aquinas, he said, we can't be sure, therefore we have to err on the side of caution. So he was anti-abortion, but nowhere near as rigidly as what you will hear in the pew. All right.
Right.
So in a strange way, it's the very fact that I was studying Catholic theology and Catholic philosophy that helped me pass through this in a way that I might have had more difficulty if I was simply a man in the pew.
Right. And I understand, I do understand that, having also studied theology, I've got a minor in it. But you know, you have this journey through the monastery, then you realize that you're gay and you're in New York. Now you became president of the GAA in 1970. The Stonewall Riots were 69. Were you at all involved in that, or had it certainly had an effect on you? If you were...
I did not come out to myself until it was about the spring of 1970. So I didn't even. So I was still in the monastery at the time that the riots took place, June 28, 1969. So I did not even hear about them until I had come out to myself and made contact with gay liberation.
Okay. Now, as archivist and historian, which you were at the center, certainly I would think that you could give us some background as far as the history is concerned.
Yes.
And what happened.
First, let me say that the best book for this purpose is a book called Stonewall by David Carter. There are several books, at least two books, called Stonewall. Look for the one by David Carter. It is both excellently researched and also very well written. the riots themselves, and some people get upset using the word riots. They'd rather use the word rebellion. Be my guest. Whatever you like, go ahead and do it. The Stonewall Inn was a bar in Sheridan Square in New York City, across from Christopher Park. And like all gay bars at the time, it was accustomed to being raided from time to time. There were police payoffs involved. There were most of them, if not all of them, were run by the syndicate. They were terrible places, but the only place we had. All right. So on this night in June, they were raided. Actually, they had been raided a week or so prior, so they were also pissed off that it wasn't due for another raid yet. The police, as always, sent in some undercover people first to get the lay of the land, and also they would want to know who were the employees as opposed to who were the customers, so they would go in incognito ahead of time. In this case, a young policewoman fulfilled that. And then later, the police, under the leadership of Inspector Seymour Pine, entered the bar. And they were determined this time to really destroy the bar. So more than usual, they were breaking up, physically breaking up the bar. They were arresting more people than usual. The bar itself would have been a mixture. The clientele would be predominantly young white guys, but also with a mixture of what in those days we would have called drag queens or transvestites, and also a handful of women would have been in the bar on any given night, and that was true that night. Apparently, the first person to give lip, the first person arrested in the bar was actually a woman, a lesbian, and people were, meanwhile, were gathering outside, seeing what was going on. They tried to arrest this woman. They put her in a police car. She just got out the other end. She did that, I think, twice before they managed to hold on to her. All of this is being witnessed, of course, by the crowd outside. They were also sending out of the bar most of the patrons, which would be normal. They wanted to keep employees, but not patrons for the most part. So they were doing that as well. More and more people started to give him lip, both those who had been in the bar and the people outside the bar. Now, Christopher Street at that time was a cruising place, the whole street. And on that street, typically, would have been a wide mixture of gays, including middle-class people in from the suburbs, but also including street people, homeless or near homeless people, drag queens, people of color. A real mixture of gay life would have been on the street. And they gathered around outside the bar and started doing things, throwing pennies at the bar. Somebody managed to dislodge a parking meter from the sidewalk and tried to attack the bar with it. Somebody had a failed attempt of a Molotov cocktail trying to throw in. So much so that Seymour Pine was frightened, and the police locked themselves in the bar out of fear. They were trying to call the local precinct for help. They themselves were not from the local precinct. They were from somewhere else. The local precinct was not being very cooperative, even though they were calling them. So eventually that young policewoman that had gone in first, who happened to be fairly slight in stature, managed to crawl out of the bathroom window and go for help. And actually the first help to arrive for them was the fire department, not the local precinct. The rioting then went on for about 3 or 4 days. The rioting, for the most part, there were some overturned cars. There were some difficulties that way. There was actually not a lot of property damage. For the most part, it was about taunting the police and then running away. Although there was some damage, there were some overturned cars. Probably of equal importance was that after the riots, the organization of the gay community that already was there in a slight form decided not to let this go, not to let this be forgotten in a week or two, and organized around it. This was not the first gay riot in the U.S. That distinction goes to, I think it's about 66 in California, as a matter of fact, all right? But people like Craig Rodwell and Martha Shelley and other people then organized around it and kept it going. And so you quickly had the formation of first the Gay Liberation Front, and then in December the Gay Activist Alliance to carry the fight on. That, in a nutshell, is what happened.
Well, I'm going to cut in here. It's time for me to take off. I appreciate you letting me be here, Carl. I wish I could stay longer. This is fascinating stuff. It was nice to meet you as well.
Nice to meet you, Chris.
As for my regulars, I will see you guys again soon, or at least you'll hear me and I'll hear you. So you guys have a great night, and keep up the good work, Carl.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chrissy. I appreciate you coming on.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right.
I'll be back longer next time.
Absolutely. So here we have the history of Stonewall, okay? And then you come in 1970. You became the second president of the GAA. And what did you do at this point to continue the fight against this type of oppression?
Well, a lot of credit goes first to the previous organization, the Gay Liberation Front, because it was not the first gay organization, but it was the first post-Stonewall organization trying to always be in shirt and tie, figuratively or literally, but to really push back. They were primarily or almost totally from the left of center, and so were seeking to make alliance with other left of center organizations, such as the Black Panthers and others. But they also they were not heavily structured. They believed that that structure was oppressive. But as a result of that, and trying to run everything by consensus, even though they were a relatively large group, they wound up not being able to do a great deal because what was decided one day could be changed the next. So a group within GLF decided that to be effective, they needed to do two things. They needed to have an organization which was more formally structured, and they needed to not only concentrate, but only pay attention to the single issue of gay rights. And so in December of 69, the Gay Activist Alliance was founded. GAA decided to be very militant, although nonviolent. And by militant, I mean things like sit-ins, things like loud demonstrations. We also, what they called zaps. It was also decided that ultimately the way to liberation was to encourage people to come out. So almost everything that GAA did had that as an underlying motivation. We found people both in GAA and GLF, for example, would walk around Greenwich Village now holding hands, kissing goodbye at the subway, for example, being very publicly out. We were not afraid of getting on TV. We wanted to get on TV with the idea of certainly highlighting the discrimination that was going on, but also as a way of saying, look, and we're still alive, so you should come out too. We hounded politicians unmercifully, and as a technique for doing this, as a hook to get this done, GAA had introduced into the city council a non-discrimination bill that would cover the gay and also the trans community at that time. That was primarily a hook. It gave us something to say we were shooting for, but more than anything else, we were coming out boldly and letting other people know that that's what we were doing, and we were highlighting and pinpointing the discrimination that was going on. So much so that typically some of the council members would say things like, well, if you'd only eliminate transvestites, we'll pass this bill. They were lying, of course, all right? But GAA always said no. Well, they said, well, we'll pass the bill if you exempt the fire department and the police department. GAA would always say no. And we said no for two reasons. We said no because it's not right to divide our community and kick some under the bus so that the rest could go ahead. And also because it wasn't, in many ways, it wasn't just about passing the law. As is obvious from racial relations in the United States, simply passing the law doesn't change everything. It's a vehicle. There's an importance to it. But it is certainly not magic. Everything is done if you pass it.
Well, isn't it also something along the lines like, you know, we're here, you can see us, and you're not going to get rid of us, and you're not going to divide us?
The phrase at the time was, we're here, we're queer, get used to it.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically standing there. And, you know, if you're pushed down, you get up again. Like, I'm not going anywhere. Push me down again.
Right.
Trust me, I know that quite well with my background. You know, I think also at this point I want to talk a little bit about what I think of as the lost years, because there was a period of time you weren't in New York. And that's where you and I met.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you've ever really mentioned this part of it, if you feel comfortable. Let's talk a little bit about how you got to Bradford, Pennsylvania.
Well, I got to Bradford. I'm terrible difficulty remembering dates. But I was the president, the second president, from something like in 1971 or 72. And once that was over, I stayed around a little while. I actually became an officer in one of the older organizations, Mattachine, which was very much on its last days at that time. But my ego told me, and this is actually fairly ridiculous, but my ego told me that I was known too well, too famous. I had to get off somewhere. So what I did was I went to approximately a year previous, I had given a lecture at Alfred University in Alfred, New York. So I knew a few people there. It was a way of getting out of the city. So I had very little money. I had about $60, and somebody drove me up there. And I had a contact that I could crash with in Alfred, New York. And I went up there. Now, when I was there, the closest gay bar, place to meet anybody, was about a half hour away in Olean, New York. And so we would go to that bar in Olean. And while I was there, I met someone and promptly fell in love with somebody who lived in Bradford. So I moved to Bradford, Pennsylvania, which at that time was a city of about 12,000. I got a job through what was called the CETA program, which was a government-funded employment program for nonprofits, and worked for a nonprofit in Bradford and stayed there for about 5 years or so before returning to New York.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is the way that you and I met was through a community theater.
Yes.
And here, you know, my situation is that I was an outsider in terms of I have some physical difficulties and that sort of thing. And to find a place where there were other outcasts, so to speak, was a wonderful thing. And so here you come from New York City dealing with all this. You come to Bradford, which, to put it bluntly, is pretty redneck. Did you have any difficulties in adjusting or things of that sort?
I was not going to go back into a closet. No way was I going to go back.
No, exactly. Trust me, I know.
Okay. And interestingly enough, I, of course, knew other gays in Bradford who were in the closet. But typical of being in the closet for most people, everybody knows, but it's not said out loud. It's an open secret kind of thing. And what I noticed when I was in Bradford was that actually that kind of person who was thought they were in the closet but weren't really actually were more often the targets of homophobia than I was. Because, for example, one occasion, and this did not happen often in Bradford, but on one occasion I was walking down the street and some young people from the other side of the street started yelling out, "faggot." I went over and talked to them. I said, "You're right, I am. Isn't it wonderful?"
And it's always
I don't want to say this is in any absolute sense, and I certainly do not want to say that those who get injured by anti-gay people, it's their own fault. It is not, okay? But yet, to a very real extent, people react to your own sense of self and pride, all right? And if you walk around thinking you're hiding, afraid to say it, feeling bad about yourself, that kind of jackass is going to react to that in a way very different than they would react to somebody who says, "yeah, so what?" So I was always open at work, everywhere. I was open, totally, in Bradford as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were certainly the first open gay that I had ever met. It's interesting what you mentioned, because I ran into that also. I mean, that particular time in my life in Bradford was very tough for me. Because being having difficulties, I have cerebral palsy, and though it wasn't, I wasn't in braces or anything at that point, but it was much more noticeable than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the taunts, the fights, the beat downs, the faggot calls, all that, you know, and that fucked me up royally, to say the least. And then I just, you know, as I said, you go to this, you find these people and you're accepted, you know, no matter what you are. And that meant a lot to me, you know, because that was a very, very difficult time. And so, you know, I don't know if I've ever said this to you specifically, but you definitely taught me a lot when I was much younger. Mm-hmm. And for that, I will forever be grateful. So, you know, want to get that out there. So you come back to New York, okay, and you become the archivist at the center. Tell us a bit about not only being an archivist, but when I knew you in Bradford, you always had your camera. You were always photographing. And you had your dark room and that sort of thing. Tell us a bit about how you got involved with photography and how that led you to becoming an archivist.
Sure. Well, first of all, as a photography is something that I grew up with. My father was actually for a while was a professional studio photographer. You know, wedding portraits, etc. Although I don't have, I was too young to remember that at the time, he, of course, continued his photography. In the house we lived in as a child, the two houses we lived in when I was growing up, both had darkrooms in them. All right, so I can remember being in my father's darkroom. Obviously, we're not talking digital photography here. we're talking what to a child's mind was you take this white piece of paper, you shine some light on it in this otherwise dark room, you put it in this tray of liquid, and a picture magically appears. You know,
it's magic.
And it certainly is absolutely magic. And the way it comes up, actually, it comes up first slowly and then just whoosh, and there's this black and white picture. So I was involved in that sense with photography quite literally longer than I can remember. So when I was in the Gay Activist Alliance then, before I became president, once I became president, I had other duties. I couldn't do it anymore. I became the person who photographed all of the demonstrations and the zaps and the police beating us up and things like that for the local gay newspaper and anybody else who would take. So the local gay newspaper at the time was called Gay in New York. And, of course, The Advocate, which at that time was the Los Angeles Advocate, and was not a magazine but was a newsprint newspaper. And so and my primary motivation there was both because I'm just naturally a photographer, but also PR for the organization. You want to get the word out, that's how you do it. By the time I had got to Bradford and then came back, I was working for a long while for a picture agency, a stock photography agency. So I was doing that and kind of was making my living that way. And I was when Ed Koch was mayor, and he had an official liaison to the LGBT community, and they decided that they wanted to do an exhibit at City Hall. So my name came up, and four of us were on that exhibit, and I was one of the people doing that, and we got that done. And then a number of years later, when the community center, especially in the person of its executive director, Richard Burns, decided that they wanted an archive at the community center, they asked around as to who they should get. And one of the people they asked was Vito Russo. And Vito, who is a friend of mine, because he had also been in GAA, suggested that they ask me. So they did, and I said yes. Now, I was not by any means, I was a photographer. I had an interest in history. My undergraduate work actually was a double major of history and philosophy. But I decided that, well, I have to know how to do this right. I could do that by joining the local archivist group, which I did. I could do that by reading certain things and learn how to do it. But at that point in time, community archives kind of had the automatic reputation of being well-intentioned but not knowing what they were doing. So I don't say that that was a fair characterization, but that was kind of what people automatically thought. So I decided that indeed I should get the piece of paper that said I know how to do this. So I went back to school for a master's in history and with a specialty in archival management, which I did at NYU. Well, this changed my entire career. This wound up then changing how I made my living also, because now I was professionally an archivist. And I wound up, for example, as a result, working for 17 years for the archive of the New York Philharmonic. But the gay archive came first and steered me this way. The gods have been very, very good to me. I've never been smart enough to figure it out. They just leave me there anyway. You know, and it's been very good for me. So I set up the archive at the Lesbian and Gay LGBT Community Center. And I was there for 26 years until about 2 years ago. So, mm-hmm. And of course, the early collecting of materials was I knew everybody. And they knew me, and therefore had a certain amount of trust in me and were willing to give me their papers or whatever. And of course, my own collection of photographs is there also. What else can I say?
Well, that gives us a great idea in how you got into all the photographs in the archiving. Now I know that there are several exhibitions that are happening right now through the month of June, and I can almost guarantee you that if you see a photograph exhibition of LGBTQ, you're going to see photographs done by Richard.
Right.
More than
at the time period, that early time period of the early 70s, there were actually in New York, there were two primary photographers of the movement. There were people photographing other things as well. But of the movement, the two primary ones would be myself and Diana Davies would be the other one. A collection of her photographs are at the New York Public Library. My collection of my full collection of photographs are at the LGBT Community Center National History Archive. Some of them are also at the New York Public Library because they received a collection from that newspaper I spoke about, gay newspaper. So they tend to be, and have been for a long time, in, you know, textbooks or here, there, or whatever. And I like that, I must say.
Well, I would too if I were you. You know, a little bit of fame is okay. You know,
yeah.
Not too much,
yeah.
But a little bit's cool.
Yeah.
So one of the things I thought I would ask as we start to wind down a little bit here is, you know, with what you have seen throughout your life and how the whole thing seems to have changed, and there's ebb and flow within how the LGBTQ community is perceived and what gains it has gotten over the years. What do you see happening now and into the future? What mountains do you still have to climb?
We are at great danger currently in the United States of going totally fascist, not only wiping out the rightful gains of the LGBT community, but of pretty much everyone, certainly also in terms of people of color and of women and you name it. We are in very, very serious danger of that happening. It is not only number 45 that is the threat. It's all of his cronies, including the ones in the Senate, who have a great deal of power and are playing for keeps. I clearly have no interest whatsoever in any form of democracy, are determined to suppress voting wherever they can in order to stay in power, and are also, of course, are playing to the basest kind of prejudice, again, not only in terms of homophobia, but certainly in terms of racism and misogyny as well. So we're in very, very serious danger there. On the other hand, in a way, the reason why 45 can have such a following is because we have achieved so much, again, not only LGBT, but also in terms of race and women as well. But it's very real. And the people responsible for it, it can be said, are people who don't go and vote, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have to end the way Germany did, but it could.
Yeah, that definitely is a cautionary stance, because I do see that also with what's happening. However, the interesting thing about that is, if you take a look at marriage equality and the general consensus of equality and LGBT rights and all that, there seems to have been real progress in terms of you know, winning hearts and minds, so to speak.
Yes, and indeed, this has worked differently in terms of the LGBT community as compared to people of color. It seems to me that a lot of the gains in terms of anti-straight discrimination laws and everything for blacks and other people of color has come first through the courts, which mandated them. It's different with the LGBT community. The changes here have been social before they've been political. And that's because of the strategy of coming out. Once we come out of the closet, well, every family knows gay people now, all right? Their brothers, their sisters, their cousins, their fathers, their mothers, whatever. So it's impossible or very difficult to maintain absurd stereotypes when everybody knows us. And that is the purpose in terms of race of segregation. If you can successfully enforce segregation, then you can say anything you want about that other group because nobody outside their own knows them and will know the lie. And because we've not been able to be segregated in the same way, the result is we have changed the social conscience, I think, faster than the political one.
Oh, I would agree with that 100%. Because you know, there's still...
The women and the
well, what I was going to say, there's still a lot of laws in that are being fought, of course, on particularly in terms of the trans community and the bathroom laws and all this bullshit. You know, it's just like, it makes my head hurt. Never mind. But you're right. The social sense of it has propelled and been the propelling force in change within the LGBTQ community. There's no question
of
that.
In terms of women, it stands somewhat in a middle ground to that. Women have been in certain ways segregated, although not in the same sense as racial communities have been. And indeed, the enforcement of restrictions upon women have largely been done by things like rape and the fear of rape. All right? So the idea that a woman cannot be thoroughly a player in whether it's the world of business or the world of public world is enforced both by women don't do that kind of nonsense, but also by fear of rape. So the mythology of rape is the unknown assailant on the street corner, while the reality of rape is almost always the friend or the family member that's doing it. But the mythology of it being the stranger successfully keeps her, or up until recently, successfully kept her out of public life.
You know, there's also the social constructs, too, that were broken within the 60s with the women's movement, you know, from the 50s in the House. You know, you started seeing the strings fray at that point, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
No, but all of it is social construct and what the stereotypes that we're fed, you know, and this is the thing that has always hit me was, you know, if you get to know someone, you immediately realize that the stereotypes are wrong.
Right.
You know, and so my feeling is, you know, if we all decide that in some way that we're being oppressed, right, whether it be, you know, handicap rights, gay rights, women's rights, economic, whatever the case would be, if we all realize that and realize we're basically in the same boat but in different passenger parts, then wouldn't this world be a little better? and when we treat each other better.
Yep.
No, so that's always been my point. Now, I thought I would bring one more thing up before we end up here. And as I said earlier and just mentioned it in passing, we had the LGBTQ Queens Pride Parade last Sunday. And I know that you marched with the senior
the Queens
group
for gay seniors.
Yes, and again, I must give them a plug. I was there today to meet you for lunch, and Abby and China do a great job there. And if you are in Queens and you are 60 years older or young or older, definitely you want to check this place out. And they have a Facebook page. And definitely want to check them out. They're on 77th Street off of 37th Avenue.
Right. Right in space at the Jewish Community Center there.
Right, exactly.
The thing is, and any LGBT person out there will know what I'm talking about when I say this. There's a reality of hanging out with our own. The comfort level of which and the ease and social ease involved is so much more than even being within a group of true heterosexual allies. And there is certainly still a lot of discrimination out there, and that's certainly a reason to go to an LGBT senior center. But also just the comfort of it and the ability to be yourself is just so much greater by going to such a place.
Well, it's just like anything else. Where are you accepted? And who do you feel comfortable enough to be who you are? You know, that and that is an important part of life. I found that over the years. And luckily, the people that I have been friends with for a number of years, and of course that includes you, but several people, you'd be comfortable enough to be who you are, and that's so important.
Well, the reality
unless
you're comfortable enough to be who you are, you cannot even discover yourself who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You need that freedom in order even to know yourself what your true self is.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Very true. So one of the things I was bringing up about the parade is that I also, for the first time, marched in the Pride Parade, and I marched as part of my church group, the Episcopal Diocese of Long Island, and I'm going to a church, St. Mark's, here in Jackson Heights. And there were a handful of us that marched. And, you know, we are a church that is accepting, and we're very, very much on the have been on the cutting edge for a number of years. The Episcopal Church has gay bishops and female bishops and so on and so forth. And I just wondered, you know, with you having studied the Catholic, you know, in the monastery, and what is your feeling on terms of, you know, religious groups that are accepting, that are more progressive? And just a thought on that before we go.
Well, obviously, there's vast differences among even the mainline churches, no less the storefront or more fundamentalist churches. This is a whole other show, Carl. But
and I understand that. I'm doing this as a bumper into one of the shows that we'll be doing this month. So
let me just put it this way. Gore Vidal once said, and I'm not sure if this is exact quote or paraphrase, Gore Vidal once said, the real problem is monotheism. Because in a world where you believe that there is only one deity, the most tolerant you can be is to say, well, I can't be sure I'm right, so we have to give the other space also. In a world of polytheism, which is the majority of the world, by the way, in the world of polytheism, you're saying, well, yeah, you and I
particularly
like...
Oh, one
like
more God. What does it matter?
Well, not only that, but it's quite appropriate that you particularly like one deity and I like another. And we're both right.
Yeah.
Even to the extent of one of those being the goddess of peace and the other being the god of war. So you would still maybe oppose each other on certain issues politically or whatever, but you cannot go so far as to say they're heretic or they're wrong in their worship.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed,
yeah,
the modern liberal Christian no longer thinks that they are the one true religion. All right.
And that's very true. That's very true. One of the things I always say... one of the things I always say is if you hear a Christian say, I know, run away screaming quickly.
Yeah.
Because they don't.
As the song says, Jesus is all right by me. I just wish the fundamentalist Christians would listen more to what Jesus said and less to what their preacher is saying.
Exactly. Thank you. Okay. And we will be talking about that on a future podcast and really delve into the religious and how people treat other people, including the LGBTQ community, but also other groups and other religions. We'll talk about that later in the month. I want to really thank Richard for doing this. Richard, as I said, you've been a friend for over 40 years, and I appreciate you spending time with us today. So, Doc, you've been listening and been quiet all night. So do you have any thoughts before we go and what you might have learned today?
Actually, yes, I do. With the Stonewall riot or kind of confrontation, there were very, very minimal injuries and nobody was maimed, you know, like how a riot today would be, like massive chaos, fires, everything like that. There was none of that, right?
Right.
That I'm very, very, that actually impresses me. It really does. And also, I'll be perfectly honest. I did not know about the Stonewall riots until Carl brought them up to me about doing the show. So This should be one of the things that should be taught in American schools as part of our history. You know, we hear about the race riots in the 60s, the Kent State, that whole mess over there. And we don't hear about things like this. And this is a vital part of American history for the fight for equal rights for everyone. We just don't hear about it, which is so sad. And I really think that, you know, events like this and others that, you know, some people may not, you know, really know about or agree with, we should be taught these things so we know about.
There are a few states now which in their education departments have begun to mandate that LGBT history be part of what's taught in their history classes. But it's still a minority of the states, a small minority of the states at this point. The Stonewall itself is now a national monument under the care of the U.S. Park Service, and they're doing a wonderful job. It's very recent that they took that over, so they're still working on preparing the best way to tell the narrative that goes along with it. But they are already doing a rather wonderful job in that way. And that's something that we fought for and were able to accomplish in the last days of the Obama administration, because it certainly would not happen now.
Yeah, I understand. Well, thank you so much for being our guest and all the information that you had, and I hope everybody remembers what we talked about tonight. That's a big thing.
You know, and the other thing, too, is of course, Richard being an archivist and the archives at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center, I would recommend anyone who is interested in learning about the history is to go to the community center and to take a look at the library and the collections there. And, Richard, can you give us an address for that in New York City, please?
The LGBT Community Center is 208 West 13th Street. They have a great many wonderful programs of various kinds, as well as being a meeting place for independent organizations. The archive and library is headed up by my replacement, a wonderful archivist by the name of Caitlin McCarthy.
Okay.
Their gaycenter.org is their web address, gaycenter.org.
Okay. Okay, and definitely you want to check that out, folks. Please follow Carl's Tavern this month. On every Friday we will be broadcasting a show that is specific to the LGBTQ community, and we'll be doing that for the month of June in honor of Pride Month and also Stonewall 50. So, Doc, can you tell us what else is in order and coming up on the net on the Deviant Legion Network?
Yes, I can. This Sunday we're going to have a really cool show on the Sludge Pit, and I discussed everything with Danae. We are going to be talking about our favorite musicals, be it movie musicals, actual stage shows, and I think we're going to hit up some pretty interesting things, like, of course, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Repo the Gen X Opera, probably Oklahoma. I'm going to try my best to get my hands on a copy by Sunday. No guarantee on Oklahoma, but we are going to have some fun.
Oklahoma, where the... Oh, sorry.
That's right.
I'm just
a boy
who can't say no.
And everybody's invited to call us and join in. So we're definitely going to have a good time on Sunday.
Okay. Now, Monday, I just cleared this with Doc. We just had... someone passed away who in the music field, who I just totally loved, and that would be Dr. John, a.k.a. Mac Rebinac, and we will be doing a show/playlist on Monday for Mac. So there you go.
And then
and on Tuesday, you'll
Doc
be having a show too, right, Doc? You'll be having a review show.
A review show, which may break off into something a little bit different. We're definitely going to do a movie, definitely a 100% Doctor Who episode, and maybe a video game. You never know. We'll see what happens.
Okay.
I'm going to try and also put in a possible book report sometime, too, but we'll get into that tomorrow. We'll get into that later.
All right. And so, again, Richard, thank you so much for being on with us. Really appreciate it. And to all our listeners, thank you for joining us. Hope this was edifying and that you want to dive in more into the history of Stonewall and the LGBTQ community. Another shout-out to the Gay Senior Center of Queens and to the Community Center in on West 13th Street. And again, thank you very much, and good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.